Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it to your iPod, iPad, any type of mobile device or computer, and hit play. Today we have a real interesting show on a unique training session on predictive coding done for 16 judges and law clerks in a single court system, the Western District of Pennsylvania. And to our knowledge, this is the first time a significant portion of a single court has been trained on computer-assisted review or predictive coding in the country. You know, what's unique here is the Western District of Pennsylvania might be considered to be a more mainstream court throughout the country than the mega court systems like in New York or out in California or D.C. And although the judges who attended the training are certainly considered prominent throughout our local region, only a handful of them have ventured out onto the National eDiscovery Speakers Panel. This program was arranged by Judge Conte, who's been creating a National eDiscovery name for herself as one of the architects of the pilot eDiscovery Special Master Program in the Western District of Pennsylvania, which Judge Fisher, who's also on the show, has helped her with. And I would like to now add this judicial training effort to that list of accomplishments, because the training was offered over 2 days, and we had over 20 of the special masters attend the training program held the second day after the judges' training, which I also attended. The training was conducted by Herb Reuplatt, a world-renowned chief scientist in the space of predictive coding and the creator of Orchitech, an analytics-based review tool, which also includes predictive coding. Herb also has the distinction of being the chairman for the Electronic Discovery Institute, which has studied search and retrieval efficiency for the past 5 years and has released a number of highly influential studies in the space of machine-assisted learning. The training lasted for an hour and a half, and Herb both demoed his tool, Orchitech, but also presented vendor-neutral data gathered from TREC and studies done by the Electronic Discovery Institute. And it was a really interesting 2 days of training. And like I usually do when I'm involved with something like this, one of my first thoughts was getting it on the ESI Bytes to share nationally with the electronic discovery community. And the three judges on the show agreed to let us get their sense or their impressions of the training and the defensibility of predictive coding. So our guests for the show are Judge Joy Flowers Conte, who's a federal district judge from the Western District of Pennsylvania. Prior to her appointment, she was a shareholder with the Pittsburgh office of Buchanan Ingersoll Professional Corporation, now Buchanan Ingersoll Rooney. Prior to joining Buchanan, she was a partner with Kirkpatrick Lockhart Johnson & Hutchinson, which is now known as K&L Gates. She co-authored 2 articles dealing with e-discovery and frequently lectures at seminars on e-discovery. Judge Conte was also the 100th judge in the country to sign the Sedona Conference's Cooperation Proclamation, which we celebrated on a past ESI Bytes podcast, along with Judge Fisher, has also been a supporter of our local e-discovery networking group, Friends of e-discovery. The Honorable Nora Berry Fisher, who's also on the show, is a federal district judge for the Western District of Pennsylvania and was appointed to the bench by President Bush on April 7, 2007. Prior to her appointment, she was in private practice in Pennsylvania and West Virginia for 30 years. In 1977, she became the first woman associate at Meyerdare Buckler Bebeck and Eck, an insurance defense litigation firm. In 1980, she was named its first woman junior partner, and in 1982, its first woman senior partner. In 1992, she joined the firm of Patrick Alabasic and Gordon as an equity partner. She served the firm as its administrative partner and a practice group leader. Judge Fisher is a fellow of the American College of Trial Lawyers. She's past president of the American Academy of Trial Lawyers of Allegheny County. Judge Mark Korniak was appointed a federal district judge by President Obama on October 19, 2011. Prior to his appointment, he was a law clerk for the Honorable James M. Sprouse for the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. And in 1982, he began the practice of law at the Pittsburgh office of Buchanan Ingersoll Rooney, where he was a partner focusing on civil litigation, labor and employment law, the representation of government agencies and officials, and the representation of broadcasters, publishers, and authors, as well as extensive services in ADR neutral. Professionally, he served as the governor of the Academy of Trial Lawyers of Allegheny County, and He also asked by far the most questions in the session that that was presented training the judges, so clearly he was very curious about the tools. Our last guest is Herb Reiblatt, who gave the training, and he's one of the pioneers in search and retrieval and the chief scientist at Orchitech, a predictive coding software package. Prior to this, he was chief scientist and co-founder of Dolphin Search, as well as an award-winning professor of psychology at the University of Hawaii. He's been awarded one patent and has two patents pending on conceptual search technology. Herb is well recognized as an expert in search and retrieval technology, particularly in area of e-discovery. In addition to his scientific work, Herb has been writing extensively about the problems of dealing with massive amounts of electronic data and the emerging standards of dealing with those problems. He's a member of the Sedona Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production, on the advisory board of the Georgetown Legal Center Advanced E-Discovery Institute, and a member of the 2011 Program Committee for the Georgetown Legal Center Advanced E-Discovery Institute, and chair of the Electronic Discovery Institute. So, great panel today, and let's start the show and talk about the training. And first, I'd like to ask each of you, directed to the judges, how you first became aware of predictive coding, and we'll start with Judge Conte, then Judge Fisher, then Judge Horniak, and then I'm going to ask, include you, Herb, and you can just talk about how you first became involved with predictive coding.
This is Judge Conte. I first heard about predictive coding at one of our local Friends of eDiscovery meetings. We were talking about different search methodologies, and I heard the word predictive coding, and there was some discussion of it. And then I was asked to participate on a panel for our Federal Bar Association meeting here in Pittsburgh that was focused on predictive coding. And Herb Reiblatt was one of the speakers, and I had the privilege of meeting him at that time. And it was a fascinating program. I naturally learned a lot more than I was able to share with the members of the audience, but I viewed it as an opportunity to bring and participate in education here locally about these upcoming trends in e-discovery. And from that meeting with Herb, he told me that he'd be happy to sit down with me and show me how it actually worked. And I had a brief opportunity at the Georgetown e-discovery program to have Herb do that for me. And I said, wow, this is something that the other judges need to see so that they can actually visualize what the talk is all about. It's one thing to talk about predictive coding, and it's another thing to see how it actually works in terms of what you can derive from it and how it can be a really helpful tool. So that's how I came to know about it, and that's why I suggested that we do this training program, and Herb was kind enough to say that he'd be happy to come and share his knowledge with us here.
And as I recall, I was sitting next to you at Georgetown. I think, Herb, you just pulled out your iPad. So we had all sorts of new technology working there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Judge Fisher, how about yourself?
Well, first I read about predictive coding. I think it was in the Legal Intelligencer. There's a columnist there who writes a column called Geek Speak, and he spoke about predictive coding. And then when Joy came back from her Georgetown Institute program, she filled me in a little bit more. And like Joy, I've participated in the local e-discovery, Friends of e-discovery meetings, and have learned about it in that fashion. But I have to say, the training put it before me in a much more clear light. Like Benny, I'm more of a visual learner, so to actually see how it's implemented made a difference to me.
Okay. And Judge Horniak?
I believe the first time I came across it was when Carl hosted a program, I believe, for a luncheon for the Pittsburgh Technology Council, which was really aimed more at clients. It was for the Pittsburgh Association of Corporate Counsel. So it was aimed at client in-house counsel. So it was a one-hour overview. And then when Judge Conte worked to arrange the program here, having practiced law with Judge Conte, I knew if she thought it was a good use of her time, it would be a great use of my time to sit down and learn more about the process and in a more nuts and bolts and detailed manner, as Judge Fisher pointed out.
Great. And Herb?
Well, I've been involved with machine learning since the 1980s and got into e-discovery around 2000. Tried to get people interested in doing what's now called predictive coding around then, but they said, oh, that's really nice, but we don't need that. I think that in the last few years, with the economy as it is and the explosion in the amount of ESI that people have to deal with and some other factors, I think that the interest in predictive coding has also exploded. And so I'm happy that we can do research and talk about these things and provide education and provide tools that I hope people like to use.
Judge Conte, I'm really curious where you got the idea to hold this training session, which ultimately touched about 36 different people between special masters, judges, and law clerks. I've never trained personally more than 5 or 6 judges in any one sitting. So this is the largest training session I've ever seen with judges in one court.
I thought it was very important that the judges on our court, particularly because we are now focusing on patent, we are participating in a patent pilot project, and whenever you have large document-intensive cases, the concepts and the methodology behind the predictive coding, I can see is the way of the future, and that the search terms are going to be an archaic methodology to search electronic data, and therefore I thought it was important that we be aware of this here locally, the judges understand it, so that if it comes up, we're educated about it, and we can make decisions about whether or not predictive coding should be something that's acceptable, which my personal view is that it should be, because it is a lot more accurate. And that's when I reached out to the members of our court, and I think we have a wonderful judiciary here. And most of our judges are very interested in learning about electronic discovery. And when I broached this, they all thought it was a great idea, and we put it together. And after I reached out to the judges, our special master said that they were very interested in it. I might say I was on a program here locally where we had a large number of our bar present. And I told them that we're behind the times, that predictive coding is the wave of the future. It's a lot more accurate, and we need to start looking at these new technologies, because the world is changing in terms of e-discovery and how it's going to be done. And after that, so many people in the audience came up and were interested in predictive coding, wanted to know more about it, and as did our special masters. And so I made that opportunity available to the special masters, and we had a good number of our special e-discovery masters interested, and they came to the program. So I think we have a great deal of interest here locally.
Yeah, there's certainly been a lot of training now, more than most jurisdictions. I'm curious. I mean, Judge Fisher, you said that you liked the visual learning at the training that Herb went through better than what, you know, we'd been able to cover at the Friends of eDiscovery, which is good actually to hear that. But I'd like to get some more feedback overall about what you heard at the training, and as well as from Judge Conte and Judge Hornack, if you thought it was useful, if you heard from other judges that, you know, or clerks that were there, what their reaction was, a positive or.
Well,
and that one question, sorry.
Well, Carl, I would say this. First off, I think that the training in and of itself reinforced my view that there has to be a better way than using search terms and squadrons of lawyers or paralegals reviewing documents in cubicles and on iPads and computers. And to that end, I think that it demonstrated for me that you need to take the technology and use it to the best advantage. Now, admittedly, going into it, it may be a little bit costly to figure out how you're going to actually proceed in an individual case. But I think as the case develops, you're going to have a lot of cost savings and you'll be much more efficient. And I think, too, more accurate in what is produced. And so I thought that what we heard from Herb and, in addition, the research materials that he made available to us gave me the impression that this is certainly something that litigants and their counsel should be considering. And from what I've read, I think many of those in corporate America who are often picking, if you will, the vendors to do electronic discovery for them are now aware of this concept. And I think it's incumbent on us in the judiciary, as well as our clerks, to at least be knowledgeable about the concept. So when it's raised in case management conferences, or if there are discovery issues that arise during the course of production of documents, that we can respond in an intelligent manner, know what the litigants and their counsel are talking about, know what the vendors are talking about in handling these kinds of disputes. So altogether, I was very favorably impressed. All of my law clerks attended with me. Many of our courts clerks attended, and our clerks run the gamut. Some are right out of law school. Some of them have had classes in e-discovery at the law school level. Others are more experienced practitioners. And there was a favorable buzz, if you will, as we left the training, that this was very beneficial to them, that they had a better understanding of what was going on in terms of the technology. And I think it's going to be useful in all of our chambers as we go forward on these issues.
And Judge Conte and Judge Hornick, then anything to add to that? Because you all speak to different people. Did you hear similar reaction from the other attendees? And
this is Mark Hornick. My sense was everyone in attendance thought this was valuable training because it really gave them insight into another new tool in both the advocates and the judicial toolbox that we're going to need to be aware of going forward, and I think was indicative of the sense of those in attendance that this is only going to accelerate in terms of whether it's predictive coding or other mechanisms that will become available to advocates in the representation of their clients. If I could just digress for a minute,
sure.
Carl, I thought it was accurate when you said that we were a mainstream court, but I think in many ways our court and the bar that practice here can take pride in the fact that we have become, I think, significant in American judicial administration. We're a fairly large court with 10 active district judges, 3 very active senior district judges, and 6 highly engaged United States magistrate judges who carry very substantial civil dockets. And both with our headquarters in Pittsburgh, which is clearly both nationally and I think on an international scale growing as a center of financial and technological and healthcare commerce, we see matters of both novelty and significance. And I think this court, through the work of Judge Conte and our chief judges that we've had, we've been at the front end of ADR programs for the litigants. We're at the front end of the special master's program for discovery of electronically stored information. We're one of only 10 of the 94 districts designated as a patent pilot court. So I think we recognize that a lot of front edge, cutting edge things are happening in our court. And our mission statement reflects the second sentence of Federal Civil Rule 1, which is we're to do our work with an eye towards securing the just, speedy, and inexpensive determination of every action. And one of the things that I've become aware of, both as a practitioner and now as a judicial officer, is it's incumbent on us and the advocates to be aware of all the various means that they can represent their clients, and we can decide matters that need decided in a way that is just, that is speedy, not for speed's own sake, but recognizing that time carries a burden both for those asserting and defending claims, and with an eye towards doing things in a way that is generates the least expense consistent with securing justice. So whether it's predictive coding or the other tools that will come our way, I think it's entirely consistent with the direction our court's been taking to not only keep up, but to try and be at the front edge of the waves of change in judicial administration.
Herb, since people listening weren't at the training, could you sort of summarize the types of material you generally covered in the training session?
Sure. We talked about the burden of e-discovery and how parties are using it to bludgeon the other party into submission and the effects that that has on the legal system. I reviewed some of the studies that have been done on predictive coding using a variety of tools, and pointed out that those studies end up giving really good results. We talked some of the research on using keywords to identify documents, and how in general it's typically found that unless you really, really, really work hard, that keywords tend to give you very poor results. They miss a lot of stuff, and they bring back a lot of stuff that you don't care to see about. You don't care to see. And then we did a short demo of our system, not because our system is super different from everybody else's. It has differences, but because it's a system that I can demonstrate when I go out, and nobody will yell at me about it. Sort of as an illustration of what kinds of things can you do with technology these days.
Okay, and let's see. I'm going to ask the next question to you, Judge Hornack. You asked a lot of really good questions over the course of the training session, and one of the questions is, why should judges care? Do you have any opinions on that after hearing the presentation?
Well, I think some of it goes, Carl, to my response to your last question. In many ways, judicial officers are responsive rather than proactive in litigation matters. We are responsible for managing our docket and caseload in a way that advances the interests of justice in light of the litigated matters, but in many ways we're responsive to suggestions or objections raised by the parties. And the realities of the costs of litigation, whether you're a claimant, plaintiff, or a defendant, mean that those lawyers that are at the top of their game so that they can be the most effective and zealous advocates for their clients are going to be aware of the tools that will allow them not only to advance their clients' interests, but to do it in an efficient and inexpensive way. So if they're going to know about it, we need to know about it. And again, whether it's predictive coding or the other advances that are going to build on it, or other ways of managing and accessing electronically stored information, it's incumbent on us to know. I think what I came away with by the end of the training was an awareness that I'm not going to be sitting there if someone raises this as a tool they're going to use in the discovery and pretrial process and say, well, what are you talking about? And for that, it was, and many other things, it was very, very valuable training.
Before we go into some of the special master questions and some of the other more technical areas, I just wanted to wrap up the training area to you, Judge Conte. And because we talk to other judges periodically about learning about these tools. Do you think this type of training for judges outside of the Western District is a good idea to continue training in this way? Or
I think it's a very good idea. there's a generation issue here in terms of the way I practice law and the way the lawyers coming into the profession today are going to be practicing law. And I think it's important for judges to keep up. And if we don't keep up, we're not going to be as effective on the bench in terms of resolving the disputes. And this is one way in terms of the discovery that's going to be happening in the future. We need to understand it and know about it so that if an issue comes up, we can address it with on an informed basis and not do something because we were comfortable with what we worked with in the past. So I think it's important to keep up, and this is a very good program educationally for judges. It's a discrete program, hour and a half. You'll learn a lot, and I would encourage any judge who has the opportunity to attend a training session to do so.
Great. I'm going to go back to one of your questions, Judge Hornack. Another really good question about whether government agencies are also using these tools such as these to sort through data. And I know Herb gave a number of examples, but he also gave an example of the spam filter being an example that we all use in everyday life with predictive coding. So do you get comfort with both examples of extremely high-level national security work being done using these tools, is the fact that we all use predictive coding in our everyday lives?
Yes, Carl. As I recall back to this session, I think the phrasing of my question was, are there other things in everyday life where matters of consequence to those involved use predictive coding or some form of it? Because I think as this method of accessing and reviewing and producing information that's stored in electronic format becomes a proffered form by more and more litigants, to the extent it's suggested, I think one of the things that will give judicial officers comfort is knowing that much as you would with a scientific method advanced by an expert at trial, the degree to which it's accepted and it is a form of analysis and information gathering and compiling that is routinely used in other matters of significance in society, I think then it becomes something that judicial officers can view more as the norm. The law changes in incremental ways, and for better or worse, the world doesn't. It moves with great alacrity. So I think knowing that there are other things that happen in everyday life of great importance that rely on predictive coding or its kin will be an important thing for judicial officers to know if when they're confronted with one litigant wanting to use it and the other either having questions or having some hesitation about it.
You know, those are great points. I was skiing this weekend with a technologist talking about this area from one of the tech companies in Pittsburgh, and my friend Dave said, if you were to take someone and beam them from 100 years, tell them about all the changes from 100 years ago and bring them to the future, the only two things they might recognize are going to school and going to court in a courtroom. Everything else seems to have changed so dramatically with technology. It's really interesting if you give it some thought, but I think we're changing too, so with some of these tools. Judge Fischer, one idea we've talked about here in the Western District of Pennsylvania is using the predictive coding training sets, including the documents which were deemed non-responsive, to be able to validate to another side and to the judiciary that the predictive coding model was properly set up, then using maybe some sampling on what was produced to show after the fact that it worked reasonably well in finding most of the responsive documents and not missing a large number of the responsive documents. This first point of looking at what was non-responsive resulted in two disagreements with my good friend Maura Grossman at the legal tech conference in New York. She, of course, wrote the highly cited study that predictive coding works better than human review, but she doesn't believe that the non-responsive documents should ever be produced. And my feeling is it goes to getting a party comfortable with the process. we're comfortable with keywords because we know if a document has that word or words in it, we're going to get it. So the only way to be comfortable with predictive coding is to see what you instructed the software not to produce as well as what you're getting. So how do you feel about letting the other side see this non-responsive data or letting a special master, an officer of the court, see that data?
Well, Carl, as you know, you and I and Judge Conte have kicked around this issue a little bit off air, and like you, I'm of the mindset that you're going to have to demonstrate to both sides, i.e. your opposition as well as the court, that what's been done in terms of this predictive coding of documents is valid and is responsive. So I would see, in the first instance, if the parties and their counsel would agree to exchange the non-responsive documents, so they each would gain a level of comfort. If they were more in line with Mara Grossman's thinking on the matter, then in that event, I think it would certainly be appropriate for the court to suggest to the parties the use of a special master, and in the event there was still disagreement, even order same, and then the special master could look at these documents in camera and make a report to the parties and or the court that, yes, what has been done here is appropriate. So I think just like people became used to the search term concepts and that type of searching, this is going to be the same kind of thing. Predictive coding, in my estimation, even though Herb's been looking at it for a number of years, is still relatively new, if you will, to the bar, particularly here in the Western District. So until people get comfortable and until practitioners who do litigation in our courts and beyond say, yeah, this works, and yes, this is a way to do it that's not only cost-saving but accurate, once that comfort level is felt, you know, across the bar, I think it'll become easier and you'll have less of a problem. Now, admittedly, there may be instances where non-responsive documents contain proprietary information, trade secret, or other information that may not be appropriately viewed by the other side, and that's one more reason why you might want to employ a special master rather than turn the documents over directly to your opposition in a case.
Herb, as you know, different predictive coding tools have different levels of efficiency, and can you describe generally how different tools work?
Sure. I mean, in some tools, you have to build a seed set, and so that means somebody has to go and find a set of responsive documents before you can begin the training. Other tools rely on a random sample of documents, and then other tools involve a combination of those two, where you start with a random sample, and then the computer tries to pick those examples of documents that it's most confused about. So that way, the theory is that you only ask people to judge the documents that are confusing to the system, that are most uncertain to the system. And so in theory, it should result in people having to judge fewer documents. In reality, you get about the same number using random samples as you do using that directed sampling. And you get the most documents, you have to review the most documents with a system that requires you to build a seed set because you have to do a lot of the searching in order to build the seed set to start with.
And that's pretty much the way I've seen it, that there's three different types of tools that are out there looking at them, and some are more efficient than others, which impacts whether you can look at the non-responsive documents easily. So Judge Hornack, you know, since we agree that different tools are more efficient than other tools in creating a training set, are you okay with just sampling at the back end what was produced and what was not produced to get comfortable that the tool worked? Or would you rather also be able to have a special master look at a training set of documents, in particular the ones that were coded not responsive, you know, which trains the software and what not to produce, if the training set was only, you know, say a few thousand documents? Because then you can correct yourself down the road quickly if you need to change your system.
I guess my predisposition, Carl, is the more that can be either resolved or taken off the table as an actual or potential issue at the beginning, the higher likelihood, in my experience, that you'll do something efficiently and with less expense. So it would seem to me that if you had one litigant that wanted to use predictive coding as the mechanism for accessing, sorting, identifying, and producing electronically stored information, and the other team either was unaware or had an objection or a specific concern, I would rely on the proponent at the beginning to most effectively make their case, first to their worthy adversary, and then if necessary to me. So it seems to me that sort of the proponent making the case at the beginning of why this fits, to steal a term from expert testimony analysis, but why it fits the facts and circumstances of that civil action, while it's some more work up front, probably in the long run would be the most effective, because they can address either concerns based on not knowing or, frankly, concerns that turn out to be legitimate in terms of the training and learning process that the search algorithm is going to use. So my default setting tends to be deal with it up front early and often rather than trying to dig through it at the back end.
Judge Conte, you had a real interesting idea that you mentioned during the training of having a special master in the Western District of Pennsylvania's pilot e-discovery special master program to use the analytics, like the sort that were demoed, to kick the tires on a data set, much like attorneys might do in the beginning of a case to assess the completeness of a production. I mean, this falls outside of predictive coding, but allows a special master to look at analytical tools, you know, email threading, timelines, network analysis, concept clusters, to investigate and see if they're seeing other documents that weren't produced. I mean, that's a real progressive thought. I hadn't heard that from anyone else before, and it may be unique to the fact that the Western District of Pennsylvania has embraced a special master's program, but do you think that could be a useful strategy in some cases?
The reason it came to my mind is because I have had several cases where during the course of the discovery process, one party will come to the court and argue that the production is not complete, that there is a problem, the other side is acting in bad faith. And when that happens, they usually have some document that they know exists that wasn't produced. And so the question for the court is, what happened during the production? What was the failure? What should the court do? Should there be sanctions imposed? Should there be costs allocated? Do they need to redo the whole production process? And so I think when those kinds of issues come up, and they will come up, using a special master to do sort of a sensitivity analysis could be very helpful to the court in resolving that problem.
And Herb, how do you think the analytics can be used by a party to get comfortable that responsive data has been produced?
Well, we can do various forms of sampling. Before I say more about that, I would like to say a little bit more about what Judge Conte just said. And that is that these disputes over whether the information that's been produced is complete or not are, in a very large sense, independent of the technology. That is, if somebody wants to hide documents, it doesn't matter what technology you're using, they can hide it. If they want to do their best and do a reasonable job of producing it, you can get disputes about whether the right documents have been produced or not. So I don't think that's anything special about predictive coding. Given that, there are a number of techniques that are useful, again, no matter how the data have been processed, analyzed, and produced. There are techniques that can be used to evaluate the reasonableness and completeness of a production. And largely these revolve around sampling. The basic idea in sampling is that if you take a random sample of some group of documents. That random sample is representative of that group of documents within the limits of statistical accuracy. And the size of the sample affects those limits of accuracy, but it also, of course, entails more expense. If you sample, for example, among the documents that have not been produced and you evaluate whether there are any unreasonable numbers of documents that have been left behind or the documents that have not been selected, that's a really good way to evaluate whether you've done a reasonable job or not. The other things that we've seen are people just trying to swamp the other side by producing documents that are only marginally relevant, if at all. We had one matter where even after the other side produced it, still only 2% of the documents were judged by the party that we worked with as being responsive. So there too, if you want to make assessments of the reasonableness of something, I think that using sampling to evaluate that is a really powerful method. You can also use various kinds of searching. It doesn't have to be just keyword searching. You can look at clustering and near duplicates to say, okay, we produced these documents, but what about these other documents that might be similar to those? Do we have to evaluate that? These kinds of tools can be used by a special master or by the producing party to evaluate whether a reasonable job has been done. And then you have, I think, all of the usual kinds of questions that the courts are familiar with. Okay, you said it was reasonable. How do we know that it was reasonable? How do we make that judgment as a court?
Yeah, I've always wondered why we don't do the statistical analysis with today's what most people use versus keywords. And I guess the answer is once you've agreed on keywords, what you left behind is sort of you signed up for the keywords, you got what you asked for. Although
yeah, that falls under be careful what you ask for. You just
yeah.
It.
No, the plaintiff lawyers I've talked about this have always said it's like go fish, and they're very scared because they just don't know what's in the data set. It's very uncomfortable for them. But anyway, back to the program. A follow-up question that came to mind when I wrote these questions is there was some pushback to using special masters at Legal Tech on one of the panels I was at because they didn't want to incur additional costs for the parties. And you know, Judge Fischer, I was curious how you would respond to this.
Well, Carl, a couple of things. First, I think Joy touched on this, that there is a generational issue. And what we see here, I think, in our district court is many times the lead trial counsel, a very experienced trial lawyer, but may not be as computer or technology savvy as you might think. And so sometimes I think that the special master can be helpful in just educating and, in effect, leveling the playing field. I think both you and Herb and others have touched on the fact that sometimes in litigation there can be a disparity and one side may not be as knowledgeable about what there is or isn't to be had by way of electronic discovery, and there a special master may or may not be able to assist. When we put together the special master program, we put it together in an effort to resolve disputes, and we specifically looked for people who had a technology background, also familiarity with the discovery issues that arose. And so those people that have been initially appointed have all demonstrated that kind of expertise to the court. Now, certainly that doesn't mean that the parties and the attorneys can't make decisions on their own without the use of a special master, and I think all of us judges here strongly encourage meet and confer, and we require people to literally sit down, and we encourage them to include their technology people so that they're all talking the same language when they make their decisions about how they're going to proceed with the discovery. The other thing that would strike me is since we are front-loaded in the federal system, since you're supposed to be prepared for the initial case conference and effectively lay out where you're going to go in this case, it would seem to me that spending some money at the beginning of the case, figuring out how you want to tackle these e-discovery issues, problems, how you're going to proceed with your searching, makes a lot more sense, literally and figuratively, than spending a lot of money on the document retrieval, review and culling of documents and coding of documents, which is now done in many instances by sometimes squadrons of paralegals and attorneys. So I just think that what we're doing with the special master is providing, as Judge Hornak said, another tool for the bar, and in effect, it's just we're shifting, you know, where the cost might be spent, spending it a little bit earlier rather than later in the process. And also, by doing it in this fashion, I think that that special master can help educate the litigants themselves, you know, about what's necessary, what must be done to conform to the rules. Because as we all know, if you don't conform to the rules, the sanctions can be onerous, to say the least.
Judge Conte, when we look at proportionality and even Rule 26G, which we talked about sort of offline last week, do you think the analytical tools are more in line with what the federal rules require, which is proportional steps being taken and a certification that attorneys comply with their obligation to produce relevant documents than the typical keyword searches?
From the education that I've had to date about predictive coding, I think it's going to be a better tool because it is, at least from the studies that have been done to date, it's more accurate. And you can get a swing from a 20% yield of productive documents to over an 80% yield of productive documents if you use the predictive coding. And my understanding as well is that the costs are starting to come down. You may not want to use the predictive coding if you have only 100 documents that you're going to be looking at. But when you start to get into the thousands, I think it's something that's going to be perhaps more cost-effective and it require less legal time to review because you're going to get fewer documents but more responsive documents if you can follow that analysis. And I just want to bring to everyone's attention this little known and little commented on rule, which is Rule 26G. For some reason, it's just not seen a lot of commentary by the judges or by the parties themselves. And what that rule requires is that anytime there is a discovery request, that request, as well as the response to it, has to be signed. And when the attorney is signing it, the attorney is verifying that it is neither unreasonable nor unduly burdensome or expensive, considering the needs of the case, prior discovery in the case, the amount in controversy, and the importance of the issue at stake in the action. So there's a burden on the counsel who is involved to make an assessment about proportionality. And they are verifying when they sign the discovery request and response that this is proportional. And if it's an improper certification, under that rule, Rule 26G, the court can sanction both the counsel and the counsel's party. And under those circumstances, we have tools already built in to our rules to enforce proportionality so that the costs of discovery, particularly electronic discovery, do not get out of hand. But for some reason, we're not looking at Rule 26G as a means to control costs.
You know, I want to mention one thing because this is amazing at Legal Tech. I was in a session. There were 19 sessions at Legal Tech involving predictive coding. And one of the last ones, I thought the moderator did a great job. There were about 120 lawyers, IT people in the room. Said, how many of you are using predictive coding? So 7 of us raised our hands. Okay, very small percentage of the room. And then they said, how many of you believe that predictive coding is more accurate, cheaper, better, faster than doing the keyword searching? 2/3 of the room raised their hand. And, you know, so when you tie in Rule 26G, you know, it's very interesting. You've raised an interesting ethical issue there. I know I'm going to be revisiting this with Judge Facciola on the Carmel Valley presentation I'm putting together in July, but I think it's a great line of thought and certainly one worth following up more on. In conclusion here at the end of the show, I just want to mention that Judge Peck at the end of the main free presentation at Legal Tech in a presentation called Man versus Machine came right out and told lawyers if he was in their shoes, he would learn how to use predictive coding right away. And as I mentioned, there was this panel where most lawyers that were in the room were saying that they weren't using it yet, even though they you know, had a lot of interest. So, you know, sort of a last question. And I'll start with you, Judge Fisher, then Judge Hornack, and Judge Connie, you may have already answered this, so you can decide if you want to answer. So are you sort of the same mindset of Judge Peck on this issue, or you still want to learn more? I mean, what's sort of your thoughts at this point?
This is Judge Fisher speaking. I would certainly be in the same mindset of Judge Peck. I think that this is a tool that's out there, and it should be used. I think that it could inure to the litigants' benefit. I think it could move things along much more quickly and ultimately more cost-effectively. I think that there's been enough study here that shows that search protocols involving machine-assisted review is substantially less than the cost of hiring dozens or more of lawyers to review documents. And once that's done, to entertain motions, briefing, and arguments over discovery disputes. Case in point, when I first came on the bench, I inherited a case that had literally over 7 million documents, and I know for a fact that one of the teams involved had 28 associates, you know, working on review of documents, and in order to manage all that, this court, literally, I had discovery conferences once a month, if not more often, with counsel. So that we could go over all the issues that had arisen in the past month in terms of their document review, hear argument, and make rulings on the record. Now, I certainly saved myself some motions, but by the same token, it was a lot of effort, not only by the court, but as well as by the parties, to get through all those documents and get the case in a position where it could ultimately be resolved. By the way, the resolution took over a week with the various parties that were involved, but the case did resolve short of trial.
Judge Hornack, yourself?
I think that all the evidence at this point points to this being a way that for the litigants will be better, faster, cheaper, which and better in the sense of accuracy and completeness during the discovery process, faster in terms of the most efficient and effective use of counsel's time and therefore the party's money, and cheaper in that dollars that are invested in the process of discovering your adversary's information have a higher return on that financial investment, because that then allows parties on either side of the caption to deploy their financial and human and professional resources in a way that's going to be most effective for advocating their cause in our court, which is really what the goal of the discovery process set up under the federal rules is to most effectively and efficiently arm the advocates to litigate zealously on behalf of their clients. And I think as this tool is refined, and confidence in it grows within the bar, it's going to trend towards the norm rather than the exception.
And this is Judge Conte. I concur with the sentiments of Judges Peck, Fisher, and Hornack.
You know, I didn't know how everyone was going to answer these questions, but I think, you know, we can conclude the show and to some extent dub this a Valentine's Day massacre of sorts of the keyword searching approach, since it's Valentine's Day. But and Herb, you don't get to answer the question because you work in the field. But I know you spend a lot of time designing software, so I know what your sentiments are in the space. So I'd like to conclude the show now, but I want to thank Judge Connie Fisher and Hornack, as well as Herb Royplatt, for joining us here at ESI Bytes. And it's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Journom, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember the show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.